Isabel County and the State of California. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas Pacific Gas and Electric Company has operated in San Luis Obispo County for a century and has contributed extensively to the economic viability and physical infrastructure of the county, and whereas Pacific Gas and Electric Company constructed two major power plants in San Luis Obispo County during the 20th century at Morro Bay and Diablo Canyon, both of which continue to provide more than 10% of California's native power generation, and whereas Pacific Gas and Electric Company has responded to countless emergency situations in the county, including restoring power to over 75,000 customers in 24 hours during the 2003 San Simeon earthquake, and whereas Pacific Gas and Electric Company continues its valuable public service by providing electrical service to the 275,000 residents of the county, now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby commend PG&E for its century of service to the residents of San Luis Obispo County and the State of California.
You didn't shake everybody's hand. Don't forget, Harry.
On behalf of the men and women of PG&E, I gratefully accept this resolution. We truly take pride in providing you with electrical power every day. This resolution will reside in San Francisco for a couple of weeks at our corporate headquarters in 77 Beale Street, and then it'll be at our community center near Avila Beach, where it'll be proudly and prominently displayed. Thank you very much again for your recognition. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Actually, as I comment to my friends who work at PG&E all the time, I have a love-hate relationship with PG&E. And one reason I was very pleased to support this resolution is when I drive down my canyon after a storm and I see those linemen hanging off of those power lines, you know, almost putting their own lives in danger so I can push a button, I really appreciate PG&E. So I was very pleased to support this resolution. With that, we go on to the next resolution. Somebody's right in front of you, and I can't see who it is that represents CDF. There we go. I could just see the top of your head, and I couldn't see who it was. This is a resolution proclaiming May 18 through 14, 2005 as Wildfire Awareness Week and California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection 100-year anniversary. Whereas wildfire is a natural part of San Luis Obispo's environment, it can and has had devastating effects on the communities of the Central Coast. Whereas Wildfire Awareness Week is an important opportunity for San Luis Obispo County Community Fire Safe Council to educate the public about ways to reduce the risk of wildfire and preserve and enhance San Luis Obispo County's natural and man-made resources by mobilizing residents to make their homes and neighborhoods fire safe by providing defensible space. And whereas Wildfire Awareness Week is an important time for residents to prepare for the upcoming fire season by creating 100 feet of defensible space around their homes to protect themselves, their property, and the firefighters of San Luis Obispo County. And whereas, in conjunction with the 2005 Wildfire Awareness Week, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection will celebrate its 100-year anniversary of preventing fires and protecting the citizens of California. CDF encourages everyone to begin working toward the goal of having a full 100 feet of defensible space. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim May 8 through 14, 2005, as Wildfire Awareness Week and celebrates the 100-year anniversary of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Now, if Matt Jenkins would like to come forward, you see this.
Thank you. Matt Jenkins, City of County Fire. Is that better? Okay. I want to thank the board for recognizing this as Wildfire Prevention Week, Wildfire Awareness Week. And it is time so that we can inform our residents that this is the time to provide defensible space for their homes, provide the clearance necessary to help us defend their homes during wildfires this season. It is California, and I'm sorry if it rains or it doesn't rain, we still have fires. We've been very fortunate this year to have a significant amount of rain, a lot of late rains. While that's good for our heavy fuels, it's created quite a grass crop. And those of you who have been trying to clear your property know that you've probably already cleared it once and may have to do it again this year. That we will start having grass fires, so we would encourage folks to get out and mow their properties. The rules changed this year. The regulations on clearance, as of January of this year, you're required to provide 100-foot defensible space around your homes. Clear rid of flammable vegetation, clear up, limb up your trees, get the ladder fuels out so the fire won't spread to the trees and onto your homes. We would encourage you to do your mowing before 10 a.m. A lot of good-intentioned folks trying to provide that defensible space get out in the afternoons when it's hot and there's no humidity. They have rock strike with their mower and they start the fire they're trying to prevent. So do your mowing early in the morning when it's cool and there's high humidity. The other thing is, again, it is the 100-year anniversary of CDF, California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, 100 years of serving the citizens of California and their resources. And coincidentally, it is also the 75th year of CDF being your county fire department. So it only took you 25 years to wise up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And, you know, once again, as someone who lives out where there's high wildland fire, I really do appreciate CDF. And it's the third time mowing the grass around the house.
Me too. Thank you.
Okay. Jim, you have something?
I just want to point out that 100 feet of defensible space does not mean a moonscape, and I applaud the efforts of CDF and other fire protection agencies to educate people living in the urban wildland interface where wildfires are a problem to landscape appropriately. And coming from Atascadero, we've had a number of wildfires encroach on the city from the west and the south in previous years, and I know there's an effort there to really educate residents about protecting our native plant species, which evolve with fire, and we can continue to use them. Again, I applaud the efforts of CDF to educate the community about appropriate landscaping and means of protecting their homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, we have one request to speak on the presentation calendar, Reverend C. Height.
Reverend C. Height, MA, public advocate. And I would like to commend CDF and all firefighters and seek to employ everyone's cooperation and understanding. And I consider that firefighting the ultimate martial art, fighting fires, hand-to-hand combat with fires. And that's what it often is, and it's putting life at risk, and it's saving life. And in the matter of PG&E, I would like to compliment PG&E for their efforts when there's emergencies. We did have a very severe storm that hit in October the 19th of last year, which really caught the county unaware. There was a lot of outages. There were a lot of broken trees falling. And I would like to challenge PG&E, as you consider the next 100 years, that you are a public service, that you consider and continue to be a good community partner. There has been concerns expressed about the possibility of the more vulnerable citizens, we do consider that we have a nuclear power plant and we may have to evacuate. And I would like to point out that PG&E office in San Luis Obispo will offer service to a mother with a stroller or a disabled person in a wheelchair if they drive into the parking lot. Unfortunately, there's a very high, hard curb to approach the PG&E office and a very steep driveway, which requires mothers with children in stroller or people in wheelchairs to compete with cars to get up to the offices. This is a pedestrian concern, and it sort of mirrors my concern that if we did have even a minor fluke with the power plant, persons who are pedestrians on foot, who limp, who are in wheelchairs or have multiple children in strollers, will there be able to get to safety? So I would encourage PG&E to consider their role in the community and continue to consider being a good community partner. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. That concludes the presentation calendar for this morning. So now is the time for members of the public to address the board on any item that is not on the agenda for today. I have several requests to speak forms, so I'll call one name, and then I'll call the second one after that, and you can alternate going back and forth from microphone to microphone. The first name is Paul Bertolet, and the second is Jesse Arnold. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, ma'am. You're doing fine. My name is Paul Bertolet. I live at 392 Pismo Street. I'm a 58-year-old...
I said good catch.
Thanks. I'm a 58-year-old A&P mechanic. I work at the airport for 19 years. I'm being denied access to the airport by airport management due to Title 24 of the county code. Title 24, they're telling me that I need commercial space and indemnity policy in order to work at the airport. This is in opposition to the FARs, Federal Aviation Regulations, Chapter 65. As an A&P mechanic, I'm not required to have a fixed base of operation. That's only for inspection authorization. I don't have inspection authorization. I sent you all a letter. I don't know whether you received it.
Can you move
it
the microphone closer to...
I don't know whether you received the letter or not.
Yes, I did.
Thank you. I need an emergency exemption from Title 24 so I can continue to eat and pay my rent. I have copies of the FARs here that I can leave with you. And as an A&P mechanic, I'm no more than contract labor. I'm highly skilled contract labor, but I'm contract labor nonetheless. As an A&P mechanic, I should have a right to any airport in the country. That's what a holder of a pilot certificate, a clean medical, and an A&P mechanic's license is. It gives me rights to work on airplanes. I'm being denied this by the county under Title 24. I need an exemption. A temporary exemption. I need to meet with any or all of you to discuss this, and I'm trying to stay alive here.
Does that conclude your comments?
I believe so.
We will try to get someone to meet with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jesse Arnold, followed by Ann Rehm.
Good morning, Chairman Bianchi and members of the board. Thank you. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. My subject is genetic engineering this morning. I am one of 49,000 people in this county who do not want to eat genetically engineered frankenfoods. And I'd like to ask the board to take up a resolution supporting labeling of genetically engineered food so that people who don't want to eat it can more easily avoid it. I'd also like to point out that my challenge, which I've told you about several times, challenging the proponents of BT corn to show me a long-term non-industry study showing safety of BT corn for human consumption or for the environment. So far, the proponents are still silent. It's quite interesting that people who claim to be science-based haven't come up with any scientific proof of the safety of something they want us to eat. and they don't want to label it either. Last time I was here, I talked about two myths. There are six myths that Cummins and Lilliston talk about in their book on genetically engineered food. So I'd like to go on. I covered the first two last time. I'd like to go on to the third myth. Myth number three, genetically engineered crops will reduce the use of toxic herbicides and pesticides by farmers. The fact is, the manufacturers of genetically engineered seeds make enormous profits from selling toxic pesticides to farmers. The reason they are pushing herbicide-resistant crop seeds is so that they can sell more of their own broad-spectrum herbicides, which kill everything green except for herbicide-resistant GE plants, to farmers, not less. According to USDA government statistics, farmers using genetically engineered seeds on millions of acres of cropland in the U.S. in 1997 and 98 used on the average just as many pesticides and herbicides as the farmers who planted conventional or non-GE crops. And it's worth repeating that organic farmers who are prohibited worldwide from using genetically engineered seeds or inputs use no toxic pesticides or herbicides whatsoever. As Dr. Charles Benbrook, Dr. Michael Hansen, and others point out in the book Pest Management at a Crossroads, the only real way to reduce pesticide use is through organic or sustainable agricultural practices, practices that include integrated pest management, crop rotation, cover crops, beneficial insects, planting a variety of crops, organic composting, manual and mechanical weeding, and natural biopesticides. And there was a report I heard on the radio about the soybeans in Indiana that are Roundup ready. People have been using the Roundup so much, now they have a weed called mare's tail that's totally resistant to Roundup. That's what's going to happen. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Ann Rehm, followed by Betty Winholz.
Good morning. My name is Ann Rehm, and I proudly say that I'm with the San Luis Obispo County Arts Council. And many of you know that our executive director, Kate Stahlberg, left our position of executive director because of two baby girls. So we're so delighted that she's able to stay home now with her baby girls. But we are also extremely excited to introduce to you this morning the new executive director of the San Luis Obispo County Arts Council. Her name is Katrin Colomarino, and she lives in Atascadero, and she comes to our county from New York. So we want all of you and the whole county to welcome her this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to say a few words?
Sure. Thank you, Anne, and good morning to all the supervisors. I'm delighted to be here in San Luis Obispo County.
And you have to repeat your name for our record.
Katrin Colomarino, and I think that I know how to pronounce Cacho Achajian's name, but maybe I got it wrong.
You have a very artistic name, too.
Almost. Artistic license. I'm delighted to be in the county. We moved here for quality of life because it's the most beautiful place in the country, and I have experience in fundraising and corporate law in New York City, and I'm just very delighted to be with the Arts Council.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome.
Thank
we
you.
We look forward to working with you. Thank you. Betty Winholz, followed by Dale McGee.
I'll be using the overhead projector. My name is Betty Winholz, and I'm speaking to you today as a member of the Save the Park nonprofit group. A year ago, I had to come before you, unfortunately, to... let me get this first picture up, if you don't mind. And I brought to your attention that state parks had been girdling trees inside the Morro Bay State Park, and I asked if we could have this not happen because they hadn't really received permission to do this. This is the grove they did. What's happened since then and why I'm back is several of these trees actually came back, and here's a closer one. But what's happened since is that they have gone back, and rather than allow the survivors of death to come back, they've gone back and regirdled the tree. This is one of the original old cuts, so I just wanted to show you that as a comparison. So you can see that this is obviously a new cut. You can see the fresh sawdust. This is one of the, on the next picture, you'll see that there's fresh sawdust and a poison hole at the base of this tree. So this wasn't something that just happened because it had once been poisoned or girdled, but it was redone when they saw that they were going to live. A month ago, I got a call from someone who noticed that a couple of the cypress that had been recently planted within the last year along Highway 1 north of Cayucos had been girdled. This person had received permission to plant these trees by Caltrans because it was in their right-of-way. And yet here we've got the girdling marks again. These happen to be in front of the Sterile Bluffs, which is now under the responsibility of State Parks again. Another place, East Sea West Ranch, these are smaller pictures. I don't know if you'll be able to see them very well, but apparently at the same time a year ago, these trees were also girdled and poisoned, more poisoned and cut. There aren't that many trees up there, and probably not hardly anyone's been up there. It's a restricted area, but these pictures were handed to me. But there were three, obviously, raptor nests up there that all now sit in dead trees. This one is right on the way to the ocean. You can see it pretty clearly up there. And there's one more. I'm coming back to ask you, though this is past history, these trees again could go back and be killed again. They didn't finish the job. There's a few left to be killed. I'm wondering if this is what we want to have happening. I don't know that they have permission to do this, so I'm asking you to, should they not have an EIR to do this? Here's their brush that was left in a waterway. I'm not sure if that is copacetic in terms of the water board. And so my concern is that this park is going to follow the way of Morro Bay State Park as well. The second thing I want to ask you is if you are aware of the habitat conservation plan that State Parks is asking for all six state parks in our county, from Estero Bluffs to Morro Bay to Morro Strand to Pismo to Montana de Oro and down to Oceano. What a habitat conservation plan is actually a misnomer. It's permission. It's the loophole in the Federal Endangered Species Act that allows you to do take.
Okay, and I give you a few extra seconds because of the your
pictures. Thank you. Let me just wind up by saying that there is a meeting on June 8th on Wednesday at Embassy Suites at 6 o'clock. I'm hoping that you send a county representative there. We were not notified, the city of Morro Bay, for the scoping of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Dale McGee, followed by the Reverend C. Height.
Good morning, supervisors. It's my pleasure to be here today representing the Superior Court. My name is Dale McGee. And we're really here just to note quite the law-related week this week. First of all, it is Juror Appreciation Week, so I want to extend our great gratitude to the over 4,400 people who showed up for jury service this past year and almost the 1,000 that served, and even to the other 80,000 who received summons, who I'm sure were willing to come if they were called. So it is quite the cornerstone of our justice system, the trial by jury, and it does not go unappreciated, the effort it takes for people to come and dedicate their time to that service. Second to note is it is Community Law Night. Again, it's our third annual open house that we co-host with the Bar Association. This is has become the courts and the bars' one time a year activity to really offer public assistance regarding legal matters in a safe environment, a non-stressful environment. Usually people do not want to come to court. This is a way of doing it differently. And really would like to encourage all of your constituents to come, yourselves. I know Mr. Linthal's already RSVP'd. And really would like to point out that this is a no-cost event that actually has access to legal advice. We understand that many of your constituents contact you on legal matters. This is one resource that you can point them to. Law Night is this Thursday here at the courthouse from 6 to 8:30. There is a variety of legal advice sessions run by attorneys. Lawyer Referral is here to hook people up with low-cost legal assistance. Over 25 agencies providing some sort of legal services will be here to hook people up. This is basically a one-stop shop is how we're viewing it. We will also offer courthouse tours and several opportunities to have sessions with judges. So in the past, over 300 people have come the past couple years. We look forward to beating that. So thank you for your time and support.
And thank you for your comments and the information. The Reverend C. Height, followed by Eric Greening.
Reverend C. Height, M.A., public advocate. See no evil, hear no evil, speak. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil is a common phrase usually used to describe someone who doesn't want to be involved in a situation, according to Home and Gardens. Because the saying is typically associated with three monkeys, one covering his eyes, one covering his ears, and the other covering his mouth, it is believed that the saying, Masuro, Kikazuro, Irazuro, may have its origin in the Nikko to Shogo Shrine, a 17th century temple in Japan. Many scholars believe that the three wise monkeys were carved as a visual representation of the religious principle. If we do not hear, see, and speak evil, we ourselves shall be spared all evil. Just as there is disagreement about the origin of the phrase, there are different explanations of the meaning of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Some contend that it is a proverb, reminding us not to be so snoopy, so nosy, and so gossipy. Others say that it is a warning to stay away from places where immoral acts are taking place. Whatever the origin and meaning of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, it is the most visual phrase in existence. It is impossible to hear it spoken without thinking of three wise but very cute little monkeys. Misuro, Kakazuro, Ewazuro. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Thank you for your comments. Eric Greening, followed by Patty Andreen.
Good morning. I'm Eric Greening. Some of you may remember that in the past, when I thought it appropriate, I've asked for a moment of silence during public comment. We have 3 minutes. There's no requirement that our lips be moving that entire time. So I'm going to ask us to honor Marlene Brown, manager of Carrizo Plains National Monument, who died last week. Her exemplary professionalism and her dedication to resource protection have helped us achieve the legacy that we see today, a fully functioning valley grassland ecosystem, something that used to be common in California and now is extremely rare. People of the caliber of Marlene Brown are also rare. Please join me in a moment of silence. Thank you. Now, one piece of unfinished business. The District 5 supervisor normally serves on the Carrizo Plains National Monument Advisory Committee, as Mike Ryan did for years. I know the county has submitted Jim Patterson's name to the Bureau of Land Management, but am unclear that this agency has formally recognized him or installed him on the committee. Do we need to shake the tree to help this fall into place? Our county, now more than ever, needs a voice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Patty Andreen, and that's my last request to speak for him. So if you wish to address us in public comment, please fill out a form and bring it forward. Thank you, Patty.
Madam Chair, gentlemen, I'm Patty Andreen of Los Osos, and I'm here this morning to comment on the piece that was in the Tribune yesterday by your CAO, David Edge. I found it enlightening and reassuring to see that there is time for the parties to consider how the application, if there is one, to develop the Delidio property will move through formal county channels. And I think it will take time for these issues to ripen. While any formal process may be starting up, I would urge your board to do what Deborah Cash talked about in her companion piece to David Edge's piece, and that is to work with leaders to understand retail trends, to try to honor the special place that voters have wanted to protect, and to balance the private interests of the DeLidio family and the public interests, and to shine a light on all the information that will be used to make the decisions with respect to that property. I think it will be one of the defining decisions of the term of office of this board, if it comes to this board, or if this board has the diplomacy and skills to work out a solution for the family. We are going to find the place where the ambitions of the DeLidio family intersect gracefully with the will of the community. And I think in my work on the campaign and on my own campaign, I found that many people want the family to be able to make a decision to stop farming some portion of the property or all of the property and to do something with the property that benefits the community. I'm not an expert on what the voters said, but I did speak with a lot of them. And of course, they liked the target. They found much of the retail to be redundant, they told me. Many thoughtful people didn't like the subsidy to the developers. They wanted the revenue to the city. So they had a love-hate relationship with the project. And I think this board has the skills, the knowledge, the experience in your collective service to the community to work on this. Please approach it with an open mind and see if you can use your informal power to work with the family, key stakeholders, the Airport Land Use Commission, and other agencies to look at all the options that will be on the table. People are clamoring for housing. There will be problems in trying to put housing there. But I believe they're not insurmountable if wise and caring leaders and community members work on seeing that the development on that property meets our true needs long-term for balanced retail, for housing, for some open space, and for a place that we can continue to have great pride in. And I thank you in advance for anything that you can do in that regard.
Thank you for your comments. That concludes our public comment period. I didn't see anyone else coming forward, so I will conclude public comment. And now is the time for the consent agenda. And I have several requests to speak forms on the consent agenda. The first is Eric Greening, followed by Billy McGuire. Bill McGuire.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening on item B1, which sets the hearing date of May 24th for the amendments to Title 26, the Growth Management Ordinance, and the recommendation is to maintain the countywide growth rate at 2.3% with a Napomo Mesa area rate at 1.8%. What I'm hoping is that there will be more to the staff report for the 24th than we see under B1. Obviously, whatever action is taken today relating to the level of severity in Napomo will have an impact one way or another, and to some extent that depends on whether the level of severity finding can lead to a positive action in actually addressing the need. The other issue that I think is sort of a missing piece is that the situation in Los Osos needs to be clarified by a water management plan that I have not yet seen. And I'm not sure when it's going to be available. I'm hoping that its findings could be incorporated into first determining the level of severity in Los Osos and then, in proper sequence, the growth rate. So it may be best to hold the Los Osos component in abeyance until that's out. I had expected it to be out by now, and there may be some people here who can clarify that. But certainly, I've always said we need to clarify and make the findings on level of severity in all resources in an orderly way before we set the growth rate. The one other thing I would say is I welcome the discussions we've had in the Water Resources Advisory Committee relative to the Napomo Mesa situation, and I would welcome having the same opportunity relative to the Los Osos situation before you make decisions there. So perhaps you'll need a hole in the donut. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Eric. Bill McGuire, followed by the Reverend C. Height.
Bill McGuire, Pastor Robles. These comments are for item B6. It has to do with the implementation of Prop 36. First of all, I'd just like to commend DAS. I don't do this very often, but I commend them for having that contract agreement with Turning Point for detox services if necessary. And second, I have a question. Is this the final year of Prop 36? Is this the last funding cycle? And if so, I'd like to know what DAS's plan is for this year, because if this is the last funding cycle and the funding ends with this, we're going to have people coming in next few months. Are they going to get 1 month of treatment, or is there plans set for what's going to happen? Third thing is, DAS stated on page 7 of item B6 that the average time to complete the program is just over 15 months. But it looks as though this only includes 140 clients. I'd like to know what the average number of months in treatment is when all the treatment clients are counted. And finally, on page 70, AS stated the dropout rate for Prop 36 clients is around 41%, or 40%, I believe they said, compared to a state average of 31%, with a possible explanation of a longer, more vigorous treatment program in San Luis Obispo County. But this figure actually includes 104 clients who are transferred for treatment to other counties. If you discard those who were transferred, I believe the figure suggests a dropout rate for those treated in this county is actually about 47% or 50% more than the state average. And I'd just like to know if that's a correct assumption. Thank you.
Thank you. The Reverend C. Height, followed by Susie Hermrick.
Reverend C. Height, MA, public advocate. B7, I would like to compliment enforcement in Pismo Beach. When you live right there with all the tourists, their enforcement of underage drinking, they do it in a manner in which people don't sense they're being enforced. There is a presence. It gives the people who do sell liquor a sense of confidence. It reminds them to be very vigilant when things get busy. And it also gives them a sense of confidence, because I think that it reduces people walking in and stealing alcohol, and therefore they don't have to, you know, confront individuals. And it provides for a very peaceful community. There's a lot of people coming from outside the area who, you know, they come to have a good time and they're going to leave and they know it. And it's very nice to be able to just walk down the street to the beach. And I'd really like to see that this idea of education and presence and reducing underage drinking in the beach communities to continue. B1, 4, and 5, you're... The county really has a policy of reducing growth. At the same time, you're moving into the government center, basically unprepared to provide referrals and services, according to B4. And I'd like to apologize to the volunteer at the front desk, because I was busy asking her numerous perplexing questions at the same time she was getting phone calls with perplexing questions. This is someone who is very polite. The young woman was trying to help me understand in the matter of posting for public meetings that meets the requirement. There's no date stamps on those. And what I was asking was... you know, who puts those up, and how do we guarantee that the requirement is being met? And she did receive a perplexing phone call, and she was trying to be polite to me. My second stupid question was, you have all these brochures about mediation. Do you have anything on affirmative action mediation? How do we avoid going to the courts? How do we avoid portraying ourselves as disabled people who are just trying to sue someone? And there was no answer for that. And I'm really going to question the county's answer to the grand jury on B4, in which they say that organizations are really disinterested in referral listings. I've heard that wording almost perfectly before, in which she's not interested in services, actually when she's fighting the county for services for her family success. Everybody's satisfied. Nobody's here at the meeting. Everybody's satisfied with transportation. The organizations aren't interested in getting a listing of county services. And we're talking about the ability to access services. And this doesn't just involve disabled people. This involves your able-bodied citizen. And I'm going to remind you that services have cash value. Services for a person's success has value.
Thank you for your comments. Susie Hermrick, followed by Julia Tacker.
Good morning. My name is Susie Hermrick. I'm a resident of Napomo, and I am currently the chairperson for the Napomo Community Advisory Council. The Advisory Council is well aware that you will be having a hearing on Item B1, the Growth Management Ordinance, on May 24th, but we would like to give you a little food for thought early. At our March 28th meeting of the Advisory Council, the following motion was passed. This motion states that the growth rate be reduced to 1% from the present 2.3%. There should be no carryover of unused allotments, and that developer/development allotments be held to 10%. Napomo, as you all know, is currently faced with some severe infrastructure problems, and we do understand, the Advisory Council understands, that without growth we will not get an accumulation into those impact fees that we need to further the development of that infrastructure. But I think the Advisory Council also recognizes the need for Napomo to maybe take a big breath and to solve some of our issues, one which may be solved today as far as the water, and just reevaluate where we're going. So I thank you for your time, and I thank you for your consideration in this matter.
Okay, and thank you for your comments. Julie Tacker, and that's my last request to speak for him on the consent agenda. So.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker. I kind of wanted to just follow up Eric Greening in his question about Los Osos. Our Los Osos Community Services District has just received a draft groundwater management plan. It raises some new concern for our basin, and our community will be looking at it at our board meeting on May 19th. Just briefly, its conclusion reads, the Los Osos Valley groundwater basin is currently in overdraft. Seawater intrusion is active in the heavily pumped lower aquifer, while the upper aquifer has been underutilized by purveyors due to elevated nitrate concentrations. This water management plan identifies 9 management strategies aimed at balancing production between upper and lower aquifer zones, mitigating seawater intrusion, and providing a sustainable water supply for the community at build-out. Current projections under the plan, however, include the need for 255 acre-feet per year of supplemental water at build-out. We have a new concern of possibly having to import water into Los Osos. Our board will look at the plan on May 19th with our community. We're going to set a hearing. We hope to have some workshops. I would love to see your interest in what's happening out there. And I don't believe we're ready to have a level of severity into this year's growth management plan for you. And like Eric said, maybe held in abeyance is kind of the place we need to be. There is a lot of people think that Los Osos is under a building moratorium, so there's no development. But there actually is development. And the development that is going on is tapping resources for future development that is held up by the ongoing sewer saga. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention, and thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments and your information. With that, I will close it to the public for the consent agenda. Harry, do you have any? I'm not being official today. Harry, do you have any?
Just follow through on B6.
Okay, you want B6. Jim?
Yes, Madam Chair, comment on B4.
And Jerry?
No.
Cacho?
None, thank you.
Well, I have also B1, B5 and B11, but just for comment, for clarification of the questions that were asked. So if someone from planning would like to comment on the questions asked about B1 or comments.
Hi, Kim Murray with Planning and Building. The item that will be coming before you on May 24th is the full consideration of the growth management system. So for Mr. Greening, there is a lot more detail in that staff report that will be coming to you on that date. In terms of the notes I've taken, I have questions about Los Osos and the water management plan. At this point, we were not recommending changes to Los Osos to allow development or allow allocations to be selected at this point. So your board will have that before you to consider on the 24th. The Napomo Community Advisory Committee's recommendation is included as part of your staff report for the 24th, or will be included as part of your staff report, and their recommendations are presented and discussed in the staff report. And the groundwater management plan is in draft form at this point, I understand. And again, since we didn't have full information on that, and also the sewer is controversial and timing is hard to describe for that project, that we wouldn't be recommending changes for Los Osos at this time. Were there other questions that I missed?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Item B, the Reverend C. Hyde had B4 on her request to speak form. But that was simply the board's response to the grand jury. Do you want to respond to that?
I think Supervisor Patterson had asked for a...
Oh, okay. Do you want to make a comment on B4? Maybe we can respond if necessary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to comment on B4, which is a response to the grand jury's report on a couple of issues regarding information and accessibility to the public on county services and programs. And I just want to say that I do think it's extremely important that the public have access and knowledge of our county government's programs and services. And I do think that the responses by the various departments to that report are good, and I certainly will be following up to see that they're implemented as the timeline indicates in the response. Thank you.
Thank you. She also had, Reverend C. Hyatt also had item B5 listed, and that's a request to cancel next week's board meeting. And if anybody wonders why we're canceling next week's board meeting, I suggest that they go upstairs and look at our offices.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof at this point in time. We will be moving our offices this weekend over to the new building. And it is, well, not total chaos. Well, in my office, it's total chaos. I can only speak for me. That's why we're canceling next week's meeting. Item B5, let's go to item B6, and I see Paul Hyman.
I didn't need to have anybody respond to it. What I was going to suggest is that, I don't know if you've got a copy of these questions, but I'll give you mine, Paul, and ask you to respond to Bill on it, and then I'd like to get a copy of that, but I wanted to add one more request in there. When you talk about an increased treatment capacity in North County, and the thing that kind of spurred me on is it said that this increased client engagement and retention, this will be accomplished through increased funding. I'd just like to see how you're going to do it. So if you've got a brief memo or something, how you're going to accomplish, that's fine. It can be done under separate cover.
Yeah, just one comment. There was a one-time redistribution that will give us increased funding for this coming year, but we can't structurally count on that money.
But I thought you could respond to him on these, and then if you would, respond to me also, and then add that one question to it. Okay, that's all I had. And then the other thing is after 16 years, I'm finding things where I didn't know they were stored, having to move. So it gets to be fun.
Okay, so you.
I just asked Paul to respond. If you want to respond to the whole board member, all the board members, and that would be fine.
Well, I think I could probably catch most of them right now, but if you want me to
go ahead, go for it.
This 05-06 is the final year of funding. There are a number of bills in the legislature right now that would authorize either another 5 years of funding. There's a dialogue about what needs to be fixed in Prop 36, for instance, shock incarceration, moving it more towards a drug court model. The folks that brought the original initiative want to cap non-treatment costs. There are a number of things like that that in these five or six bills hopefully will get resolved. So that's the first thing. One of the questions, and this is more of a legal question, is if it's not reappropriated, if money is not reappropriated, the act continues. And there's some question about whether or not there's an entitlement for Prop 36 clients. So in other words, we may have a situation where it's an unfunded mandate, but we have to serve these clients. So throughout the state, there'd be a displacement of other people seeking treatment. So those are very big concerns that are working their way through, and we would probably take direction both from our local council and the State Alcohol and Drug Programs Council. If we didn't have funding when we got to the very end of the program, we would say, okay, what's the point at which we ought to stop allowing people in and start finding alternatives? So those are big concerns, and we hope that by the time this current state legislative session ends, the funding question is answered. In terms of length of stay, the 15 months, and I've got Wayne here, he's our evaluator, but yes, we do have people coming in and out of the program because oftentimes they either have a failure that might result in a dropout of the program, then they're recontacted through probation. So in our partnership with custody, it has taken a lengthy time, but we've designed it that way because what we want is a program that reflects a very long time in treatment with an aftercare program after the 12 months and intensity. So what we found is that while we have higher dropouts, speaking to the dropout, our recidivism, in other words, people that then reoffend, our program completers are very low. So our dropout rate is higher than the state average, but our recidivism is better than the state average. So we think that that's a good thing. And Supervisor Ovett, did I answer your comment about treatment capacity?
I'd kind of like to see how you're going about doing it. So it doesn't need to be verbally here. If you can put it in a memo, that's fine.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, and I think that would be more inadequate because, you know, we're sitting here talking about results-based and that kind of stuff, and the one sentence that kind of got me is that, well, we're just going to put money out there. Well, you know, sometimes that doesn't work.
Correct.
So I just want to see what kind of a program you're doing with that, and specifically because it's North County.
Fine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And I believe that concludes the B11. You're right. Who had it? Did any of the board members? Well, the Reverend C. Hyde had one. All B11 is we need to. Well, I think
discussion. This is coming back to us for
right. It will be
for public hearing.
On May 11th? I mean, the item B11? If someone from planning would explain why it's going from a half page to a quarter page ad.
I can, real quickly.
Vicki Shelby can do that.
She can. Basically, it's done so because it's a large ordinance, and it's to allow us to do a summary ad instead of publishing the entire ordinance after it's adopted. And so it needs your approval to move forward to do that.
Okay, thank you. So that concludes the
move approval of the consent agenda items
with the changes on the
as read by our Madam Clerk.
And we have a motion and a second where we have I believe roll call.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Ovett?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. That concludes the consent agenda and the public comments. I'm trying to decide when to take a break. Let's go to item C1, and then we'll take a break after that.
Item C1 is a hearing to consider the surplus and sale options of county-owned lot on Taft Avenue in the community of Cayucas. Recommend board instruct staff to return with resolution authorizing another public auction with a new minimum bid price.
Yes, may we have the staff report, please?
Yes, good morning, Supervisor Bianchi and members of the board. On November 23rd of 2004, your board approved a resolution for us and set February 8th of this year as the date to conduct a public auction for the surplus and sale of a county-owned lot located at 402 Taft Avenue in Cayucas to the highest qualified bidder. Based on an independent appraisal of the property, the minimum opening bid was set at $240,000. The board had also authorized a 3% realtor's commission, but the board received no bids. The purpose of today's hearing is to report staff's subsequent findings to the board and ask for direction on how to proceed. In this picture, you'll see the parcel was created from a merger of remnant parcels and the abandonment of a street end by resolution of the board on July 24, 2001. The property is unimproved vacant land zoned residential single family and it abuts Highway 1. All utilities are nearby and available, including water. Survey markers are staked at the property corners to show the potential purchasers its location. The maps and pictures you are seeing today are a part of the information packet that was provided to potential purchasers and realtors who called as a result of the advertising and the flyers, and we did also have a sign on the property. Real Property Services responded to approximately 50 interested parties with information packets. The lot is approximately 4,000 square feet of sloped area. It does have an ocean view. It is impacted by freeway noise and has an unusual shape as well as other development issues. Taft Avenue, as indicated on the screen in yellow, is a split-level dirt road that will need to be improved to provide access to the lot, including a fire truck turnaround. Since the property is next to the highway, it may require visual and noise mitigation. It is also located in a geological study area and will require a soils evaluation and a suitable foundation. Interviews with realtors and developers have helped to clarify the reason for non-response to the property. Consistent response was that the project contained too many unknowns. Bidders were reluctant to bid the minimum price of $240,000 without more information to help them estimate their construction costs. In addition to the survey of the property lines already provided to the bidders, it has been recommended to provide a topographical survey of the lot and of Taft Avenue and to provide a soils report. The cost of the two reports would be approximately $6,000 and would allow bidders and staff to better determine the investment needed to develop the property and subsequent market value of the property. The board also expressed interest in other alternatives, such as the possibility of selling development credit for the property. The planning department has confirmed that there currently is no transfer development program for Cayucas. The board also asked General Services to research interest in the property from nonprofit affordable housing organizations. General Services, we did send information to People's Self-Help Housing and to Habitat for Humanity. People's Self-Help Housing stated that they were not interested in the property. They do larger projects. However, Habitat for Humanity did respond with a proposal. They proposed that the county donate the lot to them and waive all fees associated with the development and construction, including planning permit and minor use permit fees. They would attempt to get donation of the materials and the labor, but ultimately they are limited to a spending cap of no more than $130,000 in order to make the final project affordable for a low-income home buyer. If the project was not financially feasible, they requested the right to sell the property and retain the proceeds in order to develop low-income housing in other areas of the county. The Department of General Services has concerns about Habitat's ability to develop the property within their $130,000 cap, especially since the project has several expensive development issues. Based on the research that we've done, the foundation work and the improvements on Taft, including the fire truck turnaround, would likely exceed their cap. Donations can only be expected to cover a portion of the costs. If the property is likely to be sold, the Department of General Services recommends that the county sell the property. The revenue for this is anticipated in the fiscal year budget of 2005-2006. The board also asked if adjacent property owners had been notified of the sale. Both had been sent a complete package of information, and there was some initial interest expressed by both parties, but neither had submitted a bid back in February. Staff has recontacted the adjacent property owners again and asked if they would be willing to submit or would be interested in submitting any proposals for the property. One adjacent landowner is interested in purchasing the property for development with his own parcel, doing a lot line adjustment to increase the size of the parcel. He owns two lots adjacent to the county parcel on the upper side of Taft Street. His offer, which cannot be disclosed outside of auction, was well below the $240,000 minimum bid price. His proposal points out the costly development issues, including the fire truck turnaround, the utilities, the special engineering, the likelihood of special engineering, and some of the mitigations like noise and visual. He also points out the advantage of his proposal is that he could make a lot line adjustment to make the parcel more desirable for building, in other words, a larger area. The other adjacent landowner submitted a proposal that we received just yesterday. He is interested in purchasing the property to merge with his own and not to be developed. But the amount he could pay would be a fraction of what we could expect for a buildable lot. Being the downhill property owner, he is concerned that the lot, if developed, would be difficult to drain. And he states that he would be unwilling to allow drainage, a drainage easement over his own property. The board also inquired about the possibility of lowering the minimum bid of the property. With the board's approval, the Department of General Services would like to reevaluate the price after ordering and reviewing a topographical survey and a soils report. Upon receipt of the reports, we would propose to work with Public Works in order to develop an estimate cost of developing access for the fire truck turnaround and drainage plan and estimate more accurate estimate for foundation costs. We would then return to the board with a new resolution to surplus and sell the property, re-advertise a new auction date, and contact all of the previous bidders. As before, the auction would be open to the public, including adjacent landowners, and would allow a 3% real estate sales commission. The Department of General Services would also like to propose a change to the purchase terms as well, which would allow a 90-day contingency period for any prospective purchaser to further evaluate the property and close escrow. This concludes the staff presentation on this property.
Are there any questions from staff? I mean, of staff by the board. I see no lights, and I have no request to speak forms. This is time for the public to speak. Is there anyone who wishes to? I see no one, so with that, I will bring it back to the board for a motion since this is in my district. Jim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to thank staff for pursuing the various options that the board asked last time this appeared, and I realize also that the door is still open for all options when it comes back to the board. So with that, I move that we approve staff recommendation.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
With that?
For the reports?
Yeah.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will take a 15-minute break and return at 1025 max. The Board of Supervisors is back in session. May we have a staff report on item D1, please?
Item D1 is a consideration of the Main Street at Pine Knolls Drive, Cambria Intersection Analysis Traffic Signal Installation Report for the Mid-State Bank Project, District 2.
Thank you. Now can we have a staff report?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Board. Dave Flynn with Public Works Department. Today is time to review the installation of a traffic signal on Main Street and Pine Knolls that was driven by development. At your April 10th meeting, there was public concerns expressed through the advisory council about the need for this installation of traffic signal. Today, I'll give you a little background on the development as well as the traffic at that location. Pine Knolls is a residential collector street that serves a hillside area of Cambria that accesses onto Main Street. Across the street from Main Street is the Mid-State Bank Project, which is the project that has constructed the signal as requirement of their development. This is an aerial photo taken approximately a year and a half ago during the construction of the Mid-State Bank Project. You see the bank here with a new access to connect into Pine Knolls intersection. The project history of Mid-State Bank goes back almost 20 years, and originally it was proposed as a full-service development off of Pine Knolls Drive back in the late 80s. Over about a 10 to 15 year period, the project was reduced down to essentially the bank, with the remainder parcel being a conservation easement that's managed jointly with the CSD. The EIR was processed on this project, stating it would be for the use of the bank, but in both the existing traffic levels of the development as well as future traffic along Main Street, it was found that a traffic signal was warranted at three intersections in this area. This finding was also consistent with the North Coast circulation studies, which has also indicated that signals would be warranted at Main Street and Pine Knolls in the future. The specific issues of the EIR analysis done for Mid-State Bank showed was done by by outside firm Ferrin Pierce as part of the environmental review. The report noted that there were three intersections: Cambria Drive at Route 1, Cambria Drive at Main Street, and Pine Knolls at Main Street that would require signals in conjunction with the project. The first two locations are projects that are being led by the county. First, at Cambria Drive and Route 1, a traffic signal is proposed at that location in conjunction with the Cambria flood control project, which would be scheduled in the coming years. At Cambria Drive and Main Street, our department worked extensively over a potential roundabout at that location a couple years ago, and that was done concurrent with the EIR project. And so any action at that location was held off for future action by the county, which left Pine Knolls and Main Street as the mitigation required of the Mid-State Bank project under the EIR. This also serves as their contribution into the North Coast road impact fees. To update and make sure their findings were consistent, and as a result of the community expressing the desire not to have the signal, we've also done an independent analysis. We found by using the 6,000 square foot bank that was constructed for this project that the federal warrants used for traffic signals would be met in both existing and future conditions on Main Street at Pine Knolls Drive. These represent the traffic levels with the proposed bank. Currently, there's approximately 10,000 cars a day along Main Street and approximately 1,000 vehicles on Pine Knolls Drive. This location also has a significant grade coming down Pine Knolls Drive as well as grades along Main Street. In the future, we would see these traffic volumes increasing to approximately 15,000 on Pine Knolls Drive and Pine Knolls remaining relatively unchanged. In looking at the existing level of traffic on Main Street, with the addition of the bank, we would start seeing a deterioration of the level of service to a level of service D. It's also been proposed that an always stop be used in place of a signal at this location. That we found would have a level of service really of an E because of the level of delay and queuing along Main Street. As you can see in this exhibit with the line of cars waiting along Main Street. With signalization, we can assure ourselves of a level of service B at this location well into the future. Also a consideration at this location is the safe access onto Main Street from Pine Knolls Drive. In the existing case, prior to the bank construction, there was an acceleration lane that was provided to traffic heading eastbound on Main Street that were turning left off of Pine Knolls heading eastbound on Main Street that allowed them to make that turn in a two-step operation. With the construction of the bank, that acceleration lane has now been converted to a left turn lane for the signalization and access. That's removed a safety feature for the Pine Knolls motorists that would be also accommodated by introduction of the signal. Some of the community concerns that have been expressed at both the CSD and the North Coast Advisory Council.
Dave, could you talk right into that microphone, please?
Certainly. Usually I'm very loud. But
thanks.
Some of the concerns have been the intersection is operating fine with the existing level of traffic, that the signal is large and really overdone for the location, that a lesser traffic control device such as a flashing light might be suitable, that the signal may be removed for now and then reassembled later when it's really needed. And the signal could be used at other locations such as Route 1 and Cambria Drive. As a department, our concerns would be that we have shown both in a fear and peer study as well as our own analysis that the Federal Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Device warrants for traffic signals have been met in both the existing and future case. That operation of the signal provides for the safe access onto Main Street from the side streets. That the signal has been designed and laid out per the proper state standards, which governs these type of traffic control devices. And that operation of the signal provides for the best traffic flow along Main Street, as the traffic would only be interrupted when there is side street demand. That would result in really 95% of the traffic on Main Street having a green light and then only being interrupted when there is some side street demand that triggers it. This is also consistent with the North Coast Circulation Study, which has continually identified the need for a signal at this location, has met Mid-State Bank's requirement for mitigation at this site. The Planning Commission had approved these actions back in April of 2002. Our recommendation would be your board to accept the intersection analysis that our office has completed, and with that acceptance, adopt the conclusion by our office that the traffic signal should be operated at this location. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions of staff by board members? I see no lights, so with that, I will open it to the public. For those of you who are unacquainted with this process down here, I call two names. The first one goes to one microphone. The second one goes to the next microphone. That saves time, so we don't have to wait for people to come forward. And you have 3 minutes to speak. There are green lights indicate on that little stand there. when the green light is on, you have 2 minutes. When the yellow light goes on, you should begin to think about wrapping up your comments. And when the red light goes on, you will conclude. And if you haven't, I'll remind you. So with that, the first speaker request to speak is Rick Arricchio, followed by F.K. Dawson.
Madam Chairman, members of the board, my name is Rick Arricchio. I'm from Cambria. I've spoken to you before about this issue, and I do have several questions regarding Mr. Flynn's report here that I've reviewed. The first point is that all of the conclusions in the report are predicated upon the traffic counts. Most of that is what is taken from the Trip Generation Manual, which is a federal manual that estimates what will happen at a drive-in bank. There have been no counts, to my knowledge, of actual bank traffic, but instead what we have is 33 data points, 33 banks nationwide. We know there are more in San Luis Obispo City. We know for sure that this did not measure what we have in Cambria. The change that I see, the only substantive change in this study versus the EIR, is that the size of the bank has been reduced from 7,000 to 6,000 square feet, which is closer to what it actually is. What we have here, though, is one issue that has not been considered at all is that there is a second driveway at the bank. This was eliminated in the or ignored in the current study. It was ignored in the environmental impact report. That second driveway is the one that is aligned with the drive-through, so that people don't drive through the entire parking lot to get to the drive-through stalls. It's also the one that's used by the majority of residents in Cambria as they approach from the West Village and as they approach from the Cambria Drive end, which is all of those coming off the highway. So it tends to serve the Lodge Hill, the Park Hill, Happy Hill, and Leimert neighborhoods, and about the only people who use the existing driveway that they're talking about signalizing are the people who come down from Pine Knolls and a few people who come from the East Village. But that second driveway certainly alters dramatically the number of cars to be estimated at this signalized intersection. However, if we would count the cars that we have there, we will still see that this estimate is wildly over what's happening out there now. We do not have 160 cars per hour. We didn't have 320 when they went with this thing last month, with the EIR. But certainly, real-world measurement should trump what's in a textbook every time. We can measure this and we can find out. The second thing is the all-way stop at Cambria Drive was never considered, and it still hasn't been considered. That will change the flow of traffic, not the number of cars. The mention of 15,500 vehicles on page 8 is based on a growth rate of 2%. I'm not sure whether the growth rate for Cambria is still at the reduced rate below 2.3 that it was a few years ago. I don't remember whether that's expired. But certainly a 2% growth rate to go to 15,500, that's almost a 60% growth in traffic in Cambria. And it's not clear whether we're talking 5 years or 50 years on that one, but growing 60% in traffic seems like an enormous amount when the population is going to be limited in town. Finally, the warrant graphs, again, that are here, what we have here are some new graphs that are showing the
Mr.
meeting.
Mr. Arricchio, your time is up.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dawson, followed by Norman Fleming.
Honorable Supervisors and staff, my name is F.K. Dawson. I reside at 2967 Wood Drive, Cambria. I want to thank you for hearing from us and considering our viewpoint of the Pine Knolls Cambria Intersection Traffic Signal Installation Report for the Mid-State Bank Project. I have given your clerk copies of my April 5th comment during your comment period. By today's complete presentation, which I will not have time to make, and this limited presentation. After reading the report on the item and the justification, I'm going to call it TSIJR, I respectfully request that your board not approve the said report. Further, that your board direct that the presently installed signal not be made operational at this time, and a traffic control need study for that intersection be directed and authorized at this time. The report and its attached TSIJR are flawed in significant portions. It's reasonable to believe that without valid justification for an operating signal at the intersection, the county could be in a very difficult position in the event of a lawsuit filed against the county occasioned by a future accident at the intersection. Such a lawsuit could cost the county multiple times the estimated $120,000 for removal and reinstalling the signal. The attached TSIJR includes the following: Roman numeral 4, existing traffic conditions. Quoting, from the existing counts of Main Street and Pine Knolls Drive, during the peak hour, the loss level of service of the intersection would be at loss A on Main Street, and on the approach, loss C on Pine Knolls Drive. My remarks about that text is that the report also says, under Roman numeral 3, methodology, analysis of the intersection operations is based on a PM peak hour volumes with a county policy of level of service D or better. Put those two statements together, and I believe, based on county policy, the intersection does not need a signal under the existing traffic conditions. There's another significant consideration concerning a safer intersection. The driver coming down from Pine Knolls to the south entering the intersection has a difficult time seeing to the left. It would be desirable if some earthwork were done to make a safer sight distance. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to try and answer them. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. I see no lights, so I have a little ray of lights here. Thank you for your comments. Norman Fleming, and that's my last request to speak for him on this item.
Yeah, Norman Fleming, Pine Knolls resident, still alive. After many trips down Pine Knolls and turning on Main Street, I feel I'm taking my life in my hands when I make a shot across Main Street and hope nobody's coming to the left while I'm watching to the right. We need some kind of a traffic signal or a simple one-way stopping the traffic from the east, from the Cookie Crock area. I'm sure that most of the drivers headed west on Main Street don't see there's an intersection until they get a few feet from the cross street. Others in the community have said we don't need a light there. It makes it look too much like a city. But if you live in Pine Knolls and you're coming down Pine Knolls Drive, that's a 12% grade, and you just can't see both directions at the same time. We used to have a escape lane, but that's been replaced by medians. I took a survey early in April, and if my neighbor and good friend Gene Valdimi were still with us, I would have had twice as many signatures. But I got 34 signatures, and 99% of those people want some kind of traffic control, whether it be a four-way stop or a stoplight activated only by traffic headed west. Even if we have to have the existing light array that's there now, but we need something there, and the people that should decide that are the people that actually live in Pine Knolls. The people that don't live there are only commenting for aesthetic reasons. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. That was the last request to speak form that I had. So with that, I will close it to the public and ask staff to respond to any comments. And also, could you explain again how that light works, that it's green unless somebody comes from
Certainly.
The sides?
Yeah, traffic signals such as this one is traffic actuated, meaning that
to be heard in the back of the room.
When the sightseeing traffic comes in, it'll trigger the detectors to set off the computer at the site to trigger the green for the side street to enter Main Street. During normal operating hours when there is no side street traffic, the light is continually green on Main Street to favor the heavy movement. But it will provide breaks for pedestrians crossing the road, which do not currently exist in this segment of Main Street, nor provide the gaps by stopping traffic for Pine Knolls traffic to enter the enter Main Street. To follow up on some of the comments regarding use of the ITE generation rates, that is a common practice in terms of how we estimate vehicle demand onto the system. And one important thing is, while it's Mid-State Bank today, the bank can change hands, there can be different uses in the future. So we want to make sure we're using an average rate, not perhaps what we see in a snapshot in time. So in both the case of utilizing ITE rates now and in the future, it would warrant the signals. Second, for the secondary driveway that was mentioned, there is a secondary driveway, which is a right turn in and a right turn out only. At this location, to turn left out of the bank requires a left turn at the signalized intersection. And that is where the delay and the need for signal is greatest, is the left turn maneuver. Not providing a signal and relying solely on a stop sign would show delays at that location to access Main Street, you know, well up to a minute. And as traffic increases over time, would be that much greater. The signal provides for better service on that. The warrant charts we use are just standard practice to record what we have, as well as our level of service analysis is the general accepted practice of the industry. It was noted that there may only be a level of service D at this intersection. That is only for the current case prior to the bank going in. With the bank going in, the additional delays shows it being a level service E and then a level service F into the future as demand increases on Main Street. And it was noted that the projections on Main Street may be overestimated based off of 2% growth. And this is over a considerable distance of time up through 2030 in terms of our horizon year when we would see development. But a lot of the traffic increases we see on the North Coast is just more additional recreational traffic and just a background growth that isn't necessarily related to the number of residential permits being issued. With that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Are there any other questions? Well, I have a comment. This has been an extremely difficult situation because time has gone by between now, when the lights went in, and several years ago when the lights were required of the Mid-State Bank project. The lights were a result of the environmental impact report and the traffic studies done, and the secondary traffic study that was done when it was only the bank, not as some people think that they took the traffic study from the entire project that had been discussed originally, but there was a secondary traffic study done. And that EIR, or that project for Mid-State Bank, went through the entire government process. It went from the Advisory Council to the Planning Commission. And at the Planning Commission, no one spoke against the light. And it was public information that that light would go in. There were two articles in the Cambrian prior to the Planning Commission meeting, and then the Planning Commission meeting where no one spoke against the light and everyone spoke for the project. Unfortunately, as time went by, people forgot that process and that it was not some weird notion that all of a sudden I decided a light should go in or Public Works decided a light should go in. It was a result of a lengthy process. To take that light out, could you describe that, what it would take to take that light out, and how much it would cost?
My
To remove the light at this point would be to take out all the wiring, all the components, as well as all the hardware and poles at this location. And generally, from our experience with remodeling other type of signals, would run approximately $50,000 to hire a contractor to remove it and store it. It would also cost an equal amount to then put it back in the future when it's needed. And that are all costs that are unanticipated, that aren't paid for under the road impact fee, since that's a mitigation account, not doing other type of actions.
And Midstate Bank paid to put the light in the first place, right?
That's correct. It's their contribution to the road impact fee.
And program. Also, approximately how much would it cost to have the second traffic study done in order to prove that you didn't need the light, because it's already been proven that you did need the light?
I can't give you an exact figure of what it would take to, you know, prove a negative, but certainly to hire a traffic engineer to do some additional follow-up studies would take at least probably another $5,000 up to $10,000.
Can you use electric wires for Christmas tree?
Yes.
With that, Madam Chair, I move staff's recommendation.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
And
not that I'm in any rush to go to the next item, but I thought.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to make one comment. And when I was about 15, I remember the very first house that was built in the Pines. And, you know, I cried because my community was going to change and it was going to be different. But in the meantime, I have had so many good friends move into the Pines that I'm glad that my desire not to have any houses in the Pines didn't follow through. Some good things have happened since then, and I have a lot of good friends in Cambry because of that. Okay, with that, we will move on to item E1.
Item E1 is consideration of the level of severity of the water supply in the Napomo Mesa area in the 4th District.
We must have... there's staff. Yeah.
Excuse me just a minute while I figure out this
okay. Well, for the radio audience that can't see our staff getting the equipment set up, please be patient. It's not dead air. We can see visual, but we can't see audio. We're still working on it.
Did you want an Altoid?
And we're still working on it.
Okay.
Almost ready. Well, I could do a song, but I don't think people people would appreciate that.
John's hurrying. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I can use it.
Hey, that's Patrick for one.
Okay, what about over here?
Yeah.
Okay, are we about ready?
Thank you for filling the airtime.
Okay.
This is...
And your name for the record.
Oh, I'm John Hand with the Planning Department. This is a hearing on reconsideration of level of severity and other water supply issues for the Napoma Mesa. Let me give you a little background on this to start out with. Last year, the staff performed a resource capacity study at your direction on the water supply in the Napoma Mesa area. That resource capacity study was heard before the Planning Commission in September, and then later at your board on November 2nd. And our recommendation at that time was that there be a level of severity 3 for water supply in the Napoma Mesa, that there be an increase in our effort to monitor water levels in the Mesa, that there be additional conservation measures established to help mitigate the disparity between supply and demand, and that supplemental water should be required as a condition of approval for general plan amendments and land divisions. That was our staff's recommendation. On November 2nd, your board took action on that recommendation and did agree to adopt better water monitoring procedures, to adopt a whole array of additional conservation measures, and the board certified a level of severity 2 for water supply in the Mesa. Then on December 14th, we brought to your board the annual resource summary report, which contains a summary of all the resource status throughout the county and in specific areas of the county. It contained a reference to your board's action in November, certifying the level of severity 2 for water supply in the Mesa. And based on public comment that you heard at that time, you agreed to schedule another meeting to consider, again, the level of severity of water on the Napoma Mesa area. And this is the time when that rescheduling has taken place. The basic issue, here's the November 2nd. November 14th, you approve the annual report. Now, the basic issue is this imbalance between sustainable yield and water demand. This is a Table 8 from the Resource Capacity Study, and if you look at the bottom row there, you'll see that there's a surplus or deficit total. In 2003, there appeared to be a deficit of about 2,600 acre-feet per year. With that deficit growing to 4,000 acre-feet per year in 2010 and 4,600 acre-feet per year in 2020, and even larger deficit at build-out. This is a comparison between the dependable yield of the basin, which is estimated to be about 6,000 acre-feet per year, versus a total demand in 2003 of 8,600 acre-feet, rising to 10,000 in 2010 and 2020. But the question that we have to ask ourselves here is, how do we enable development to continue at some level without increasing this imbalance between sustainable yield and demand? This is a question that came up at a number of stakeholder meetings that were sponsored by Supervisor Ashajian. No one at those meetings really was saying that all development on the Mesa should be shut down. That was not seen to be an issue. But they wanted, there was a consensus that the imbalance needed to be addressed, and that some measure should be found where we could allow that development, a certain amount of development, to continue. Now, this was in the context of we have to think about the purpose of the resource management system, which is to avoid the adverse consequences of a resource deficiency. So one of the ways we can do that in the POMO, well, actually there are two ways. There's the import of supplemental water is one way to do it, bring in water from outside the basin. The other way is to conserve water at a greater rate than is now being now being done, and the Napomo Community Service District, for example, is committed to an increased conservation effort that they feel will result in a 15% conservation of water over and above what they're using right now. So that 15%, for example, could compensate for continued development of projects that already have their approvals on the Mesa. This would be building permits, this would be minor use permits, conditional use permits that have already been approved or are in the pipeline. What it probably could not compensate for is if we approved any more general plan amendments, which would increase the amount of development potential on the Mesa, or for land divisions that would increase the number of buildable lots on the Mesa. In order to compensate for that kind of increase, it seems clear that supplemental water would have to be brought into the Mesa. So the answer to this question of how do you enable development to continue without increasing this imbalance between yield and demand seems to be a requirement that supplemental water should be provided as a condition of approval for any GPA, general plan amendment, or land division. Another question that came up was how can we require all new development to share in the cost of bringing this supplemental water to the Napomo Mesa? There seems to be, or the Napomo Community Service District is working presently with the City of Santa Maria to try to bring 3,000 acre feet of supplemental water to the Mesa. But, you know, that has a cost attached to it, and the question is, should the customers of the Napomo Community Service District be asked to bear that entire cost responsibility, or should that responsibility somehow be shared with other development on the Mesa? And the answer to that question, most people seem to think, although there is some disagreement on this, but most people seem to think that sharing that cost is a reasonable approach, and that the way to do that is to require supplemental water as a condition of approval for general plan amendments and land divisions. So that if someone came in that was outside the service area of the NCSD, for example, we would say, yes, we can process your general plan amendment or your land division with this condition that you provide supplemental water, and that would mean that they would be in a position of having to negotiate with the NCSD to provide that water. The other question that came up was this issue of level of severity 2 or level of severity 3. And in the staff report, there's a lot of dialogue in that staff report that seems to point to a level of severity 3. And the resource management system is quite clear as to what constitutes a level of severity 3. It says a level of severity 3 is where the sustainable supply of the resource is exceeded by the demand, and that is clearly the case that we have in the Napomo Mesa. There is a consequence of adopting level of severity 3, and that is that every project would have to prepare an EIR. Even small projects normally would not have to prepare an EIR would be required to do one, and that would there would be a obviously a cost involved, which may be too onerous for some small projects to assume. And, of course, there's an increase in time in the processing of those projects. So given that, how can we avoid this situation? Well, it seemed as though if these other mitigations can be put into effect, namely the condition of providing supplemental water for general plan amendments and land divisions, that would provide a mitigation that would make levels of severity 2 an appropriate level. This is kind of a practical approach to the problem. And there does continue to be, I should say, there does continue to be a little disagreement as to whether there is an overdraft in the basin or not. I mean, basically, the information that we've received from our consultants and from the Department of Water Resources leads us to that conclusion. But there are other people who look at other expert testimony and think that we may not be at that point. So there is still some disagreement about that issue. However, I think everybody seems to believe that some creative response needs to be taken here in order to address the water situation on the Mesa. The question is, all right, when will supplemental water become available so that general plan amendments and land divisions can satisfy their conditions of approval? At this point, the fact that the NCSD is working with the city of Santa Maria toward a solution and toward the supplemental water transfer doesn't necessarily make it real in terms of CEQA. CEQA requires that there be a reasonable, identifiable project. And at this point, that project remains a little bit on the speculative side. So the question is, when would it become real? I went backwards. That doesn't work. This is a little graph here that shows a timeline for general plan amendment approvals, for land division approvals, and for the Napomo Mesa, or the NCSC Supplemental Water Project. And you'll see that if an applicant for a general plan amendment were to come in here in the middle of 2005, he might expect to get an approval, let's say, by the end of 2006, optimistically. On land divisions, if someone came in for a land division in 2005, he might expect to get an approval on that sometime during 2006. But you can see that the progress toward the supplemental water solution with the NCSD is going to take a little longer than that. The EIR is not scheduled to be approved until the middle of 2006. And I'm not sure. I haven't seen a schedule for when construction on the project might begin, but let's say that didn't begin until 2008, and the project might take a year to complete, and so it might be in 2009 before it could be completed. Actually, at the time that the project were to begin construction is when we could say that it was essentially real water and that we could issue permits based on the general plan amendment and the land division. They could go ahead. But in the meantime, those applicants would have gone through the process up to the point of getting approval, but prior to the point of getting actual building permits. And so they would have saved some time during that period, during that process. So this is what we sort of envision would happen if you put on that condition for general plan amendments and land divisions. What is the status right now? We did a survey of this back in July of 2004, and at that point we had received a number of applications for, this is just land divisions here, we received applications for that would result in 28 lots in the Napomo Mesa, and no further action had been taken on those at that point. They were just recently submitted. Applications representing 213 lots were on information hold status, where we were seeking additional information from the applicants. 424 lots had been approved but not yet recorded. 653 lots had been recorded but no permit had been issued. And another 68 had been recorded with permits issued, for a total of over 1,300 lots. We updated that recently. On this map, you see the green line, which represents the Napomo Mesa area. The blue line is Napomo. The other red lines are urban reserve lines and village reserve lines for Callender Garrett, Palo Mesa, Woodlands, Black Lake, and one other that I'm forgetting.
Summit Station.
Yeah, but the orange and the green patterns indicate where we have currently approved and currently pending applications for land divisions. The orange is approved and the yellow is pending. Now, some of those are outside the boundary. We don't have to worry about those. But it shows that some are within the boundaries of these areas, these urban reserve lines and village reserve lines, and some are outside those lines. And it's what we're trying to do with this proposal for conditioning general plan amendments and land divisions is to capture those that are outside the urban reserve lines and outside the service areas of existing water districts and bring them into the pool that would be sharing the cost of the supplemental water. So these conditions of approval would apply to all general plan amendment applications and land division applications anywhere within the green line. Now this, go back a minute to this. This total here back in a year ago, that represented approximately a six-year supply of lots at the present rate of development. So it seemed as though there would be, you know, if these lots were considered to be outside or in the pipeline to the extent they wouldn't be affected by anything you do today, there would still be development taking place on the mesa. That total, the total for this map represents the orange approvals represent 533 lots that have been approved and 451 lots that are pending approval. And this was as of March of 2005.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
When you go back to those numbers you had, not all those are in the NCSD, which you've shown on your map. And
no, those are all. Those are on the mesa.
These are lots.
But those are lots.
Number of recorded and not issued. Are these preponderance of them in the woodlands?
I'm sorry, what?
The preponderance number of those lots in woodlands, because we had allowed so many lots per year.
No, I don't believe those are in the woodlands.
Because there's something like 800.
The woodlands is ultimate build out for woodlands is something in the neighborhood of 1,300 lots.
But there was like 600 or something a year we were allowing for the first
time. Yeah, I think between now and 2010 there would be like 800 or so units built, according to their.
Well, you had program. One. You had the next picture on it. You show a triangular piece in the woodlands.
Yeah, that shouldn't be shown there. I was trying to get that out before I came over here, but I wasn't able to delete that. So that. The numbers I gave you, the 533 and the 451, don't include that piece in the woodlands. As you know, the woodlands is proceeding along on a separate schedule. We have had some correspondence since December. We have received some settlement points from the court in the litigation proceeding, and that's in your packet. We received a letter from the home builders, which is also in your packet. We've received a communication from the Napomo Community Service District, and you also have that. And what you don't have is a letter from the Water Resources Advisory Committee, which reviewed this material, reviewed the staff report at their meeting last week, and they recommended level of severity 3. And I have copies of that to hand out to you.
No.
Got one in the mail.
I haven't looked at my mail today. It's signing papers.
So.
I was given one.
In conclusion, if your board directs staff to make supplemental water a condition of approval for GPAs and land divisions, we will prepare an ordinance for your consideration and bring that back to you at a future meeting, and it would be a meeting as soon as we can get the thing prepared, which might be in a couple of months.
Okay, I have one light. This is the time for questions. Okay. Jim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions for staff. Mr. Han, you made reference to this issue going before the Planning Commission last fall.
Yes.
What was their recommendation?
They recommended level of severity 3, and they recommended the full range of mitigations that we had in that recommended at that time, which included the condition of supplemental water for general plan amendments and land divisions.
Okay, thank you. You presented a series of questions earlier that were addressed at community meetings. Was the question asked how we resolve the imbalance that currently exists between the dependable yield of the basin and the projected demand on that basin in the future? Because even the supplemental water that is currently being discussed does not fill that deficit. Was that question asked or considered?
I don't recall that we discussed that at those community meetings. However, that was an issue that was discussed at the Planning Commission and at your previous board meeting. The answer is that it requires more than supplemental water. It also requires a measure of water conservation in order to reach a balance. And the NCSD is proposing 15% water conservation. In fact, for any increase in their service area, that would be a condition of increasing their service area based on the action that was taken by LAFCO. My own research indicates that I think a greater measure of water conservation can be achieved over and above the 15% if additional measures are added. I think there is a potential for a greater than 15% conservation. So I think that at least for 2010 and 2020, which is a roughly a 4,000 acre foot per year deficit, the combination of supplemental water and conservation could accommodate that deficit, or could make bring it back to a balance.
Okay.
For the build out, that would be another question. It's difficult to see how much, where you could conserve that much or bring that much supplemental water in to solve the build out imbalance.
Okay. Thank you. And one thing else, you said there's currently about 1,386 lots that are currently approved, and that represents a 6-year supply, and that these projects, since they're already in the pipeline, would not be affected by any action that we currently take. Is that correct?
Not the action that's being proposed. Your board could, of course, say that even those projects would require supplemental water, but that's not what we're proposing at this in the staff report.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Shadi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure John is glad I didn't call in sick today. Several questions, if I may. And some of the questions I want to ask early on so that folks from NCSD will probably help us with an answer. When you presented the severity, or when Planning Commission made that decision, was also the staff's recommendation that you go to level of severity 3, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a comment made on page E14 where NCSD customers could reduce demand by 15%. How would we manage the same with outside other water purveyors? Is there a method that the same can apply to them, and how would we monitor that so that it's not only their customers that's suffering from a...
That's a problem. NCSD, of course, is on record as saying they are wanting to achieve that 15% reduction, but we haven't heard that from other water purveyors, and I don't think we have a way to mandate them to do that. This is only going to come about through a cooperative effort on the part of the water purveyors in the Mesa.
Now, I know our discussion is going to get warmer early on, if I may change my question to a comment, Madam Chair. I want to thank everybody that participated in our discussions. It's been several meetings. I want to thank our staff folks from NCSD, Builders Association, and water purveyors that attended our meetings. I want to be sure that early, and I thank you for your efforts. I hope we're still talking after this. And on E15, where, in my view, the breaks the camel's back, and I know my last meeting with the gentleman from NCSD, we have a disagreement, and I came back to staff, and I also included the council. I want you both be able to comment on this as I ask the questions, because I want our discussion to be also discussed publicly. And it's on E15, which says on the second paragraph that if level of severity 3 is certified, all development projects would be required to prepare an environmental impact report, because any increase in water demand would be a Class 1 impact, which is a significant impact, and that could not be mitigated. And this is where I have my problems, and we keep going around and around, and I don't see any satisfaction, because, as you all recall, last week we had a young gentleman in front of us who resides in this single-family home on Taft Street, but happened to be in a commercial zone. And he wanted to change it to a residential so he can get financing for his house. Now, if that was to come in front of us under level of severity 3, that would have required an environmental impact report.
That's right.
And I know that there is a disagreement, and I want to turn over to our counsel to say if that's golf balls, because that's my biggest problem with dealing with severity levels. And of course, if I had my option, I would not have 1, 2, 3, because then you're stuck with these numbers rather than talking about a package conditions that could say this is where we are, this is how cautious we need to be, and we need not to get to a point, because if you go past level 3, there is no level 4, says at this point. It's moratorium, no questions asked, no if or buts or maybes. It gives us such a gray area that we're always going to be having challenges. But going back to my question, which is really the basis of why I have difficulties with this, is just that. And Mr. McNulty, would you like to answer that?
Yes, I'd be glad to. I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's Office. Madam Chair and Supervisor Shadian, as you know, the determination on individual projects that come before the county as to whether or not they require an environmental impact report or a negative declaration or an exemption or some other form of environmental approval is made on a case-by-case basis. The test, when it comes to an issue like water and the water resource, is whether or not a fair argument can be made that approving the project might result in a significant environmental impact. And so my concern is, and it's I think a reality, that if the board adopts the level of 3 for water in Nipomo, it will be an official action of the board acknowledging that the water situation in Nipomo is so severe that any further development would result in a significant environmental impact. If you look at your framework for planning, the description of level 3 is on page 3-11. It says, this is the most critical level of concern. Level 3 occurs when the capacity, that is the maximum safe yield, of a resource has been met or exceeded. Now, if that's not the definition of a significant impact, then I don't know what is. So my concern is that although your example with the individual residents changing from one land use designation to another might not require an EIR, many projects that today typically wouldn't receive an environmental impact report but would be processed under a negative declaration will probably be looking at performing an environmental impact report on the water issue alone. And that is, there's the issue not only of whether the individual project will require, will cause a significant impact to water, but there's also the question, of course, of cumulative impacts. And that argument goes that any further draw on a basin that's already at capacity might be considered a significant environmental impact. The courts of appeal have been addressing this issue of water capacity and supplemental supply a lot in CEQA cases over the last couple of years, and really the question comes down to how certain is your supply of supplemental water? When will it be online? Are agreements in place for it? Have construction plans been drawn? Is there financing in place? And when those things begin to line up, then you can rely on the fact that a project is definite and allow subdivisions or general plan amendments to go forward despite the fact that there isn't a current existing source of water.
Source of supplemental water.
Source of supplemental water.
Also going to court decision, and it has a comment on E19 where it says, frequently the court issued a document entitled Nippon Mesa Settlement Terms dated January 19, 2005. The document proposes that 3,000 acre-feet of supplemental water should be shared by NCSD Woodlands and names. Is it sharing of the supply or it's also sharing of the cost?
I think the intent was that the cost be shared by those. Yeah, I don't want to put words in the mouth of the court, but that's what I assume.
Do we have the? What is the very latest from the court settlement, or has there been a decision that's final?
It's my understanding that there has been no further definition of the settlement points that are in your staff report, but there may be others here in the room who are involved more closely in the litigation than I am that might have more up-to-date information.
The water, the supplemental water that's coming from Santa Maria, even though I'm asking this question to staff because I would like to have NCSD folks respond to it as well. The agreement, and I discussed this issue with members of NCSD, is exclusive just for NCSD. And outside the NCSD, if a private water purveyor wants to negotiate a deal, let's say with Santa Maria, because he or she is outside NCSD's boundaries, would they be able to go to Santa Maria and not be violating or be able to get a deal, or this exclusive agreement is for the entire Nipomo Mesa?
I presume here you're talking about the agreement to try to reach an agreement that the NCSD has reached with the City of Santa Maria. I haven't actually seen that agreement. I've seen it described in a number of places, but I haven't actually seen it. There are representatives here today from the Nipomo Community Services District, including their council, Mr. Seitz, who might be able to tell us whether or not that exclusivity provision would prevent Santa Maria from reaching an agreement with someone other than the NCSD.
First on the request to speak.
And when NCSD voted against state water, of course, that's now... they cannot go back and purchase any state water. Does that ruling apply to the rest of the community outside NCSD boundaries? The reason I ask that, because I know the farmers did pay to get state water. Now I wonder if an outside source can pay the farmers to buy their rights, and if state water is available, as we know it's available in Oceano that we have purchased, given some to have some of the areas within the Royal Grande boundaries, would they be able to go to that source and purchase it, or how is the law going to interpret that?
I spoke briefly with our Public Works Deputy Director who's been working on the State Water Project, and I asked him to be able to either have himself or Mr. Honeycutt respond to your question, because I don't know the answer well enough myself. I haven't been involved in the State Water Project up to this point.
Can we ask Mr. Honeycutt to respond to that as a staff member?
This is Frank Honeycutt with County Public Works. I'm not quite sure your question.
You have a real quiet voice, so pull the microphone up so the people in the back of the room can hear you as well.
Okay.
The question is, there are farmers who have access, in Nipomo, who have access to state water. We know that for a fact. But the NCSD, because they voted against state water, they can't go to state water. They have to purchase from Santa Maria the groundwater, then it will be mixed with state water, whatever it might be. Folks from outside the boundaries of NCSD, can they strike a deal with existing state water to purchase that water? Or does this exclusive agreement with NCSD and San Maria prevail them from doing that? I'm just trying to see how exclusive this is, because we as government putting out all competition, which is detrimental for free enterprise. Like trying to see what's available out there and what can a local developer might be able to do.
I think the biggest limitation there, and it might be a little different than your question, is that the pipe, once it goes downstream of, say, the Lopez connection all the way into Santa Barbara County, we really don't have any access rights to that. So it's not just a matter of getting the water, it'd be a matter of getting the water to them. So virtually nobody could get water out of that pipe without making an arrangement with the folks in Santa Barbara County.
Isn't that the Central Coast Water Authority?
Yes, that's the parent organization that's operating it. But you'd have to make a lot of deals, and I don't think the climate is right for any of those deals.
I know that in our county there is an source that the farmers had paid about $25,000 to have access to the pipeline, and only 2-3 years ago they were in front of us to purchase state water either from San Miguel or Oceano, and then they backed off for one reason. We end up selling it to Morro Bay. I know
I'm not aware of any farmers in the South County that have access to the state water. There are some provisions in the North County with Shandon and all that, but I'm not aware of any in the South County.
I think it was Shandon that bought the water.
Yeah, I think they bought it from Shandon, and this same group wanted to buy, and they're backed up, but I think that is within our county. But we'll hear from NCSD folks their comments on this issue, too. Thank you for your response. The rest of my will be comments and not questions, and I'll be happy to wait.
Okay. Well, I have Mr. Patterson. Then these are questions, right?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up with Mr. McNulty and his description of a Level 3 and what such a designation would trigger as far as an EIR is concerned. My question, Mr. McNulty, is if there are required mitigations in place already, as is proposed currently by staff, would that not solve that question that you raised regarding whether or not there would be long-term irreversible impacts on the water supply if projects were conditioned, even though we have a level 3 condition, if a project was mitigated to the point where it would not exacerbate that condition? Isn't that the same, really, for a level 3 as it would be for a level 2? I mean, the condition doesn't change. It is what it is. And the resource condition, in this case, the water condition. And if we have it mitigated in advance, does it still have to go through that lengthy process?
Chairman Bianchi and Supervisor Patterson, I think what I wanted to get across to you was that the degree to which we consider it mitigated depends on how far along the source of supplemental water is. That's what the cases seem to say. So if, for example, we were to say, well, we'll approve the subdivision map, but it just simply can't record until there's supplemental water, we have to decide, what does that mean? Does that mean that the supplemental water is available on site? Does that mean it's available somewhere in the community? Does that mean it's been paid for and is being planned but has not yet been delivered? There's a continuum from an idea to provide supplemental water to actually delivering it, and somewhere along that line, it's dependable enough for us to say, yes, that's been mitigated. There's at least one case that says simply approving tentative maps with the idea that they can't be recorded until there's supplemental water doesn't solve the problem, because an EIR is an information document that's supposed to allow you to understand all the impacts of providing water to a project and what those might be. Now, there are other cases that stand for the opposite proposition, but the appellate courts are trying to define just when you've adequately mitigated a water impact by by either suggesting or demonstrating that you're going to provide supplemental water.
Madam Chair, can I follow up on that?
Yes.
If you use that theory, then the school mitigation fees would not qualify, because you charge a school mitigation fee basically in the thought that sometime they will build more school space. So I'm saying that your theory in this case doesn't seem to hold.
Well, Supervisor Ovid, as I mentioned, there are among the appellate courts in this state, there are differing opinions about when the water is wet enough to be considered mitigation for a water impact. As we know, the school impact fees, the example used, are set by the legislature, and that amount can't be increased. Whether that amount satisfies your need for school capacity or not, that's what you're stuck with. The local government can't do anything about it.
But the one issue I have with this is that in those cases where you have either a mutual or some kind of community system supplying the water, they have a different impact, and those people have the overlying right. Those people have overlying right have basically the right to a specific amount of water. And EIR or no, they basically have the right to the water because it is there.
That's true, but if they're seeking a discretionary approval from a government body that's got to issue a permit that's subject to the Environmental Quality Act, then it's the government body that's got to determine how the exercise of that right is or is not going to result in an environmental impact.
But our requirements under our ordinance only say that in those cases you have to prove you have water. And they do. And in the only other case where it's more than that, it would be like with the Woodlands, where you have subdivisions of over 500 where you have to actually prove a 20-year supply, which was proven. And we're all still in the same basin. So it complicates this thing more than just the cut and dry saying, if we do an EIR or we don't.
Well, I guess the point I wanted to make is that if the board reaches a consensus about this question of how dire the water situation is, whether it is dire or not, if it decides that it is on some level, then at that point we're going to have to face this issue on larger projects or on many, many projects. So.
Okay. I have a question. I see no more light, so I get to ask my question. Is it possible on these EIRs to have a focused EIR on water alone?
Yeah, I'll throw that back to Tim. I think the answer is yes, but go ahead.
Yes, it is possible.
Okay.
As a practical matter, when you start to do an EIR, there are other mandatory sections of CEQA that are required to be addressed in an EIR, and of course you can apply a large amount or a small amount of resources to those other sections. NAPOMO has other issues other than water, and so once an EIR is begun, issues like traffic, for example, that we talked about last week, also come up and need to be addressed.
Well, considering that this is a water severity level, why would you want to bring traffic into a water severity EIR?
It's possible to try to draft a narrow EIR. Of course, people, when you circulate an EIR, everyone comments on it, and then the comments have to be responded to, and you've got to stake out your position on other environmental issues as well.
Okay. And this is for my own clarification. We've touched on it already. The EIR requirement would be also for single houses as well as land divisions and GPAs, general plan amendments, GPA?
Not for single houses, since that is not a discretionary approval.
Okay. So it's for land divisions and GPAs?
Right.
Okay. And then I have a question that may seem off the wall to the public, but it's not off the wall to me. How long is closed session going to last?
20 minutes.
Madam Chair, we'll do it after.
Wait a minute. He said 20 minutes last week, and it was an hour and 45. I'm trying to figure out our schedule for the rest of the morning. I really hate to do this to the public, because I used to be a member of the public, and it would just really tick me off when the chair would say, well, we have to come back at 2 o'clock. But considering the items that are on the closed session today, I don't think it's going to be over with in 20 minutes. And so considering the fact that we have to have closed session and lunch before 2 o'clock, I'm going to say that we are going to stop this hearing now and we'll continue it at 2 o'clock. And believe me, at that point, we will be able to hear you much better. Mr. Blair, you have a question. If you would come to the microphone, I'll let you ask one short question that requires a one-word answer.
Why not take some public comment till 12 o'clock so some of us can give public comment and we can listen to it on the radio as a decision you make?
Because I'm going to close it right now.
It'd be nice if we could just, you know, there's some
Blair,
of us that do have other things to
Blair,
do.
You're out of order. I have one request to speak for him on closed session, the Reverend C. Height, and then we will return at 2 o'clock. In the room, please leave quiet. Our public comment for closed session. Thank you.
Reverend C. Height, M.A., Public Advocate. I want to congratulate you for improving your significant exposure today. Your public citizens understand that they're being heard when they get response and referral. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that you remain vulnerable going into the 2005-06 budget hearings, that you put money into computers instead of people in 2003, and it took 2 years to realize there's a communication and service accessibility problem. Your emails are on transit agendas, but not published on county as county representatives. You were mute when offered internet research concerning the despair in Slo County, and almost a year later, public health recognizes the high suicide rate in the press. Hope, advocacy, and services are a life requirement for success and independent living. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that you profit from failure and there is no safety net. There are pronounced obstacles, hurdles, and barriers to the provision of services which specifically disadvantage persons with cognitive and perceptual disability. The county is descending from crisis into chaos. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that the county has a reputation for not providing services. You recommended neutering the ADA and the gauntlet facilitated by your services crisis, health care, housing, human services, leaves the most vulnerable, the protected class of citizen, open to discrimination. Affirmative action was an unlisted, unused, and under-advertised process since 1984. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that you ignored affirmative action requests to review the updates on the ADA and UNRU Civil Rights Act and attempted to balance the 2004 budget on the backs of at-risk youth and the productive disabled. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that the old board created a history of belligerence to the provision of services and indifference to referral to county services. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that when God, Mom, and Apple Pie show up to fight for a compassionate compromise in the 2005-06 budget hearings, you're looking at a class action suit. I ask you to change. You are changing, and I respect that you have very difficult times ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. With that, we will adjourn or close? Close it to the...
You're closing it to the public.
And we will return at 2 o'clock. Thank you.